This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think this will be remembered as some of the most consequential litigation of its time, no matter how it ends.
A few years ago, we discussed a high-profile case, Giuliana versus the United States, brought by 21 remarkable young plaintiffs across the country. The plaintiffs, most of whom were children when the case was first filed, essentially argued that their government had a legal obligation to protect them from the effects of climate change, an obligation they were failing to meet. This week on Sea Change Radio, we get an update on the lawsuit from journalist Lee Vandervoo, who's chronicled the case in her new book, As the World Burns. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives and hear a bit from our 2017 conversation with Philip Gregory, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in the Giuliana case. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by journalist and author Lee Vandervoo. Her new book is called As the World Burns. Lee, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
This book is about Giuliana versus the United States. Why don't you first give a quick overview of the case for our listeners?
Sure. Giuliana versus the United States is a climate change lawsuit, and it was brought against the federal government by 21 young plaintiffs who charged that the U.S. government's promotion, essentially, of a fossil fuel energy system violates their constitutional rights to life, to liberty, and property by fostering climate change.
So we had Philip Gregory on Sea Change Radio in 2017. He was one of the lead attorneys for the plaintiffs in the Giuliana case. So I've been hoping for a update on the case over the years, and your book does a great job of laying out a very complicated case. If you could give an executive summary of the legal case that the plaintiffs were making, and then how the different courts viewed the case that they were making, that would be terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, what the plaintiffs charged was that by permitting, subsidizing, and authorizing a fossil fuel energy system, the United States government had basically promoted climate change and was violating the youth plaintiffs' rights to a livable planet, a future livable planet. In the early days, the case was filed the lawsuit was filed in 2015. I think a lot of people considered it to be a legal long shot or some sort of media ploy. There were enormous amount of attention on the case by the fossil fuel industry, which got standing in the court and made numerous attempts to have it dismissed. The U.S. government made many attempts to have it dismissed, both under Obama and also under Trump. And it persisted, and it was scheduled to go all the way to trial in October of 2018. And then what happened was that the Trump administration deployed a pretty rare legal maneuver to stymie the case. And essentially, trial was delayed. Then it was halted altogether so that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals could hear an argument about whether it should go to trial at all. Essentially, the government argued that the case was too burdensome to defend and that there was no constitutional right to a livable planet, something that a lower court had ruled and what was essentially paving the way for the Giuliana plaintiffs to go to trial. The Ninth Circuit sided with the government on that one and found that not necessarily that the youth claims didn't have merit, but that in order for the court to order the United States government to develop a climate remediation plan, essentially the courts would have to supervise the executive branch for years and years, and that would be a violation of the separation of powers. So that's where the case stands now. The plaintiffs have appealed to the Ninth Circuit again, asking for a full review of the court, an en banc review, which means that every judge in the circuit, and not just a panel, would again consider this argument. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether the court will grant that and what the path for appeal might be going forward.
So one of the judges who was in the minority in that case, Judge Josephine Stanton, she had some interesting analysis of this, which I found compelling. What did she say exactly?
She said, "The injuries experienced by plaintiffs are the first small wave in an oncoming tsunami, now visible on the horizon of the not-so-distant future that will destroy the United States as we currently know it. What sets this harm apart from all others is not just its magnitude, but its irreversibility."
And yet, that was not the view by most of her colleagues. So the Ninth Circuit has ruled that essentially the executive branch can't be forced to enact policies that might have longer term views than their 4 to 8 year term, essentially. That's what it seemed like. It was like, well, if you're not going to be president for 16 years, how can we talk about policy 16 years from now? Is that a correct reading of what the judges were kind of hinting towards?
I don't know that it's quite that, actually. I think it's merely that ordering the executive branch to develop a plan to address climate change essentially means supervising the development and execution of the plan, whatever it would be. And climate change is on such a long timeline that would require the courts to supervise the executive branch literally for decades. And that was something that the judges didn't feel they could do, that it was a violation of the separation of powers in this case to order the executive branch to act.
Let's take a step back and recap what we spoke with Philip Gregory about, and that's the beginnings of the case with these 21 children who are now not all children. There's a real interesting story behind that. If you can kind of give us a snapshot of a few of the names behind the case. I remember seeing Chutez Kahl Martinez on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, I think back in the day, and he was quite the face of this case, but there were many personalities behind it, weren't there?
Yeah, sure. The lead plaintiff was Kelsey Giuliano. She's a native Oregonian and very active in climate change from a very early age. She walked across the country in support of climate remediation as a young kid, and she is the namesake of the lawsuit. I think she was, gosh, I don't want to guess at her age when it was filed. Her co-plaintiff, Chutez Kahl Martinez, is the Earth Guardians youth director. So he's been promoting climate change activism since very, very, very young, literally about 6 years old. There's videos of him giving his first talk. He actually is one of the only people to ever address the United Nations who's not affiliated with government. And he did it in three languages to advocate for climate remediation and a climate plan for worldwide. You know, they're supported by, you know, the other, their co-plaintiffs, their 19 other co-plaintiffs include two young men from rural communities in southern Oregon whose family farms are threatened by drought, extreme heat, increasing wildfire, and by a liquefied natural gas pipeline that is proposed to cut through the region. There are a number of plaintiffs who suffer from worsening allergies and asthma. The youngest plaintiff, who lives on a barrier island off the east coast of Florida, is looking at you know, his community essentially being swallowed by water in his lifetime, and not in the not too distant future, and has been evacuated numerous times out of the path of hurricanes. There's a plaintiff from Alaska who's dealing with melting permafrost and the loss of his Arctic lifestyle, essentially his long history of competitive skiing and snow sports and just living in a community where things are cold. Similarly, there's a plaintiff from Bend, Oregon, who was a competitive skier who spent one of her high school seasons practicing on snow-free ground. So, you know, these plaintiffs are already experiencing the impacts of climate change, and they brought the lawsuit to essentially promote change, but also to advocate for different outcomes for themselves. I remember something that Kelsey said to me in early days, which was, you know, I joined the lawsuit because I was worried about people like Levi, the youngest plaintiff, and what the future would be like for him. Now I see that he's worried about himself. So already, even within a generation, the concern is recalibrating.
Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? You're only dancing on this earth for a short while. And though your dreams may toss and turn you now, they will vanish away like your dad's best jeans, denim blue, fading up to the sky. And though you want them to last forever, you know we never will. You know. Patches make the goodbye harder still. Oh, very young, what will you leave us this time? There'll never be a better chance to change your mind. And if you want this world to see better days.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author and journalist Lee Vandervoo. So, Lee, how did these children in the Giuliana case come together?
Well, before the Giuliana case, there was an attempt at a lawsuit on the federal government over climate change, and it attacked the government another way. It said inaction on climate change was a violation of constitutional rights. That case didn't survive longer than 2 years. But while it was moving through the courts, it got a lot of attention, and it generated interest from youth activists who were interested in being involved in something like it. You know, at the same time, Our Children's Trust, which is the legal nonprofit that filed the litigation on behalf of the plaintiffs, had also filed state-level litigation in 50 states. So they were visible to young people involved in the climate movement as a place to go if you want to be a plaintiff in a lawsuit and approach your activism, you know, through the courts in this way. So I know that some of the Giuliana plaintiffs approached Our Children's Trust with their interest in being plaintiffs in a lawsuit before this case was formed. I know that Shutezkat and Kelsey, who are the lead plaintiffs, were already plaintiffs in state-level litigation, and that through their networks, they also recruited some of the other plaintiffs.
And we kind of skipped to the epilogue of the book, As the World Burns, and we kind of gave away where things stand right now with the case, but maybe you can kind of recap some of the highs and the lows for the plaintiffs. There were some victories along the way, weren't there?
Yeah, there were some significant victories, and enough so that people who were very skeptical of whether this case could survive in a courtroom became, you know, surprised again and again by its success. One of the most significant victories was a lower court ruling that young people have a right to a livable planet. That's very significant, and it was a constitutional right, so that buoyed the case forward. That was a major victory.
And what stimulated your interest in the case? Why did you decide to write a book about it?
You know, I'm in Oregon. I'm a journalist here. And so this was a case that was playing out in the U.S. District Court of Oregon to, you know, maybe an hour and a half to the south of me in Eugene. I live in Portland. So I was seeing a lot of the fanfare and the media, and you know, there's a lot of climate conscious people who live here, so the discussion about it was always lively. And I just started to get really curious, like, is this going to go all the way to trial? And it was watching to see if it would. And in 2018, in the spring, it seemed clear that the case was headed to trial in October. And at that point, I started to wonder, well, who are these people behind this case? Who are these young people? And I had questions that I think a lot of people had looking at folks this young headed into court against the government. Were they really able to articulate the case for the planet, or were they being stage managed in some way, or were they props for the law firm? Like, I wanted to know. I found those things not to be true in interviewing them over time, but it was definitely a curiosity that propelled me. And so in the summer of 2018, I started interviewing the plaintiffs and traveling to the regions where they live to report on climate impacts there and understand what brought them to court.
And they're all such compelling people in their own right, and I can imagine they're going to be moving on to great things. Did the case bring them together to work together towards this common goal, or have they been kind of, because of geographic constraints, kind of having to work in smaller subsets?
I think a little bit of both, but I would say for sure that these are 21 people who are having a very, very unique experience, and they're in it together. And so that sort of in the trenches mentality and camaraderie that comes from that experience, I think is very binding for them, and is probably a huge part of their experience. I mean, I don't want to speak for them, but I can say that seeing them together, there is a certain energy around putting them in a room or putting them on a stage that is very unique. And you know, many of them, about half the plaintiffs are from Oregon, so they do have relationships outside of the lawsuit and work on other things together. And some of them have been active in different climate activist groups together for years.
And as wildfires threaten your community up there in Portland, I'm sure the plaintiffs themselves who are living nearby you in Portland are witnessing firsthand how climate change can affect one's lives so quickly.
Oh, absolutely. And they have been here before. I do know that some of the Eugene area was evacuated. I haven't been in touch with the plaintiffs there to know whether they specifically were evacuated, but I do think, you know, they are very close to the fire line right now. It's hard to imagine this isn't affecting their lives. The air quality here in Oregon is atrocious. If you're watching the national news, then you know that Portland has had some of the worst air quality in the world for days. Everybody is shuttered inside. In my home, we have towels on some of the windows just to keep the smoke from seeping in. It's pretty dreadful. They're experiencing that too. Alex Losnack, I know, is on his farm in just outside of Roseburg, Oregon, where there has been a tremendous amount of smoke. And he was photographed the other day wearing a respirator against a backdrop of a very red sky. That is scary. And that's exactly the scenario that brought Alex to this lawsuit, fear of wildfire, and Jacob LaBelle as well. And now they are living that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist Lee Vandervoo. Her new book is entitled As the World Burns. So Lee, if we look back on this case maybe in 10 years, what do you think the legacy and impact of Giuliana versus the United States will have on the legal view of climate change? And do you think it'll also maybe have some sort of impact on policy as well?
It's hard to say where the legal view will go, but it's certainly true that all over the world, young people are bringing these lawsuits against their governments, against world governments, charging that they have a right to a planet that's been maintained in a healthy, livable way. Certainly that's the case that the Giuliana plaintiffs have brought. And I think, you know, no matter where it ends, it has been a socially galvanizing lawsuit. And I think that, you know, it's brought questions to the court that society needs to ask, you know, do young people have a right to a livable planet? And if so, is the government obligated to protect that for them? I think this will be remembered as some of the most consequential litigation of its time, no matter how it ends.
You said sail across the sea, long past thoughts and memories, childhoods and your fantasies, merge with harsh realities. And then as the sailor's hoist, your eyes were growing moist, and all the fears never voiced. So you have to make the final choice.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist and author Lee Vandervoo. So you mentioned the Trump administration employed some different tactics from the Obama administration. Maybe you can kind of compare and contrast how the administrations approached this case.
Well, both presidential administrations sought to dismiss the case. That's true. You know, and some of the legal grounds were the same. It's too burdensome. It's not the place for the courts to address this question. What's different about what happened in the Trump era is that the Trump administration used the writ of mandamus to dismiss the case, and without getting too nerdy about it, essentially what that is it's kind of a nuclear option in the courtroom. It's an emergency writ that's filed essentially to a higher court saying, this lower court is harassing us. You need to bring them in line. We shouldn't be in a courtroom. This should not be a court case. It's a pretty rarely used legal maneuver. And to give you an example of how infrequent its use really is, over the 16 years prior to Donald Trump becoming president, this was something that had only been used 8 times. Both by the Bush and Obama administration. Since Donald Trump became president, since his inauguration, between his inauguration and in October of 2018, at the point when the Giuliani case was canceled, Giuliani trial was canceled, the writ of mandamus had been used 16 times by the Trump administration, 10 of them in the month that the Giuliani trial was canceled, and numerous times in this particular case. In every case that it was used to kind of halt the courts in proceeding with litigation that was close to the president's agenda. So the rights of young dreamers to remain in America, the immigration question on the census, the transgender ban in the military. These are some examples of cases where this was used.
The book is called As the World Burns, Lee Vandervoo. Lee, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
Now let's turn to the Sea Change Radio archives for a moment and hear a little bit from our 2017 conversation with Philip Gregory, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs in the Giuliani case. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Philip Gregory. He is an attorney with Cotchett, Petrie, and McCarthy in Burlingame, California. Phil, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex.
If this case had moved forward under a Hillary Clinton administration, how would you have
foreseen the fall 2017 case proceeding as opposed to the reality that we have right now with a Trump administration?
Sure, certainly. The standard we have to meet for one of our claims is substantial indifference. Obviously, with had Hillary Clinton been president, she had views on addressing climate change that were, I'll call it 180 degrees different from this current administration. So we might have had a tougher time proving substantial indifference under President Hillary Clinton, but it's going to be less difficult to prove under the present administration that views human-made climate change as a Chinese hoax. We believe that we're going to show substantial indifference, especially in light of the testimony of the various appointees in their confirmation hearings.
And what is the goal of the case? What would be considered a victory?
Sure. So our case, we're focusing on climate science, and we are going to bring before the court the various national and international climate scientists who will establish A, that we have a serious problem, and B, what the target parts per million should be that our federal government is forced to focus on. And then we're hopeful to get a court order that, like in the civil rights cases, will force the Trump administration to devise a plan and implement that plan to achieve a target, which we believe should be 350 parts per million.
So if the Trump administration goes forward with repealing the Clean Power Plan, for example, that would grease the skids for your case, is what you're saying.
It's very interesting that when the government lawyers in 2016 were arguing this case, they were saying to the federal judge, well, look, we've got all these regulations in place. We've got the Clean Power Plan. So you, judge, don't need to do anything because the regulations and the Clean Power Plan are steps showing the president is fully prepared to protect the present and future generations. But obviously, under the Trump administration, he's going to get rid of the Clean Power Plan, and he's going to get rid of the same regulations they were arguing are in place to protect future generations. As a result, we think that our case is going to be more significant. In fact, the Washington Post has called our case the trial of the century because we're going to put climate front and center, and we're going to see how the Trump administration responds.
Philip Gregory, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's great being here.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Eddie Harris, Cat Stevens, and Pink Floyd.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.